It's on, the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. Buy two select laundry appliances and get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop all things Maytag, including the new stackable Pet Pro laundry system that removes pet hair from clothes. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Greetings, travelers. I just wanted to let you know that we made a little bit of an announcement because Mark Muncy, one of our fearless co-hosts here on the Erie Travels podcast, is unfortunately going to have to take a step back. Mark suffers from epilepsy. If you're an avid listener, you may have heard us talk about that. But he's had some difficulty with both in-person and events and some of the podcasts. So he's going to take some time to focus on his health. And of course, the Erie Travels team wishes him well. But Bo is going to step up and help me co-host. And we're going to bring in a bunch of other friends of the podcast and keep it going with, I'm sure, Mark somewhat behind the scenes, cheering us on and giving us all of his stories to share with you guys. So we wanted to let you know that was coming up, but thank you for your continued support of Erie Travels, and we will see you on the other side. Greetings, travelers.
Greetings, travelers. We're here.
We are. We are. Well, we are at least present. I don't know how here we are.
We survived Dragon Con crud.
And we did. I just want to say that we actually have a breaking news I didn't tell you about.
Oh, no. Breaking news.
There's a news article that says a meteor is going to hit the Earth today, but scientists say it's okay. That's literally the headline, but scientists say it's okay.
That's okay. We had one just come over and hit Asheville while we were at Dragon Con, and we missed it because we were there. It was a big blue ball of fire in the sky, and a lot of people sent us pictures of it, which was cool. So
I don't know about missed. I think that wording is interesting. But I don't know. But today's a really fun, exciting episode, Mark.
I am super excited for this one because we've got a special guest, which are always fun. We're recording this live on YouTube, which is always fun. And not Starlink for the meteor this time.
Yes.
And they were actually grounded that day.
It is super fun. I hope you don't go too crazy with nerding out over this one, because I feel like this is right up your nerd out genre.
We are kindred spirits. So
you are. And we got to meet this amazing, amazing human at Tennessee Terror. And it is spine tingling September. So it's perfect time to talk to him. So do you want to call forth, or shall I say, summon
let's bring him on without any further ado and allow him to introduce himself here. So
yes.
Hi, Alan.
Wow, I've been summoned on Spine Tingling September. It's quite a treat.
Yes. Tell the folks at home who you are.
I'm Alan Searcy. They call me the American Haunt Historian. I do tours in Gallatin, Tennessee, and I was telling somebody, they're asking what I do for a living. Like, well, I'm a historian. They're like, you're a haunt historian. So I'm going to steal that. So I stole it, put them on business cards.
That's good. That's good.
It's very clever. So you've got to give this some up. So you are an author along with being a historian, right?
Yes, ma'am.
How many books do you have?
Oh, man, it's over 20. I've lost track. I dropped a bunch of them yesterday, and I'm not sure. It's over roughly 25, maybe. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, we're so prolific, and my gosh, that we don't know how many books we put out. I love it. So where did you start, though? Where was your first one?
Oh, man. The first one I did was back in, was it 2018? It was Ghost of Gallatin. The titles I have is Southern Ghost Stories, Ghost of Gallatin. It's a long story how I got started, but I started writing a book. Gallatin's a small town outside of Nashville, maybe 20 miles to the northeast. During the Civil War, the square burned down numerous times. They were hanging folks behind the courthouse, lots of historic mansions where things go bump in the night. And I wrote that one. It surprised me how well it did. I kind of did it just to see, just for fun. And it took off, and I just kept going. I mean, Tennessee, there's so much history in Middle Tennessee from the Civil War, from slavery, the Native Americans, just horrible fire codes, just a lot of weird, bad stuff happens. Has happened in this corner of the universe. So I did Gallatin, went to Murfreesboro, Franklin, and all the while I was dabbling on Nashville. And by the time I got to Nashville, I broke it up and did four different books because there's just so much stuff, you know, right there by the river and all the craziness that happened back in the 1800s.
Yeah, Nashville's wild. We're working on a Smoky Mountain book, and we're starting it in Chattanooga, and we realized, oh my gosh, Chattanooga has become a third of the book just because there's so much that happened right there. So.
Yeah, Chattanooga's got, I mean, they got cryptids, they got ghost stories, you know, the Reed House, the Tennessee River Monster. I mean, Chattanooga, there's a lot of history in Chattanooga.
Yeah, we're excited. Yeah, it's going to be fun. Old Green Eyes, if nothing else. All right, so you started doing that, and now you're doing ghost tours as well?
Yes, sir. Just kind of a natural progression. I wrote the book, and folks were asking me, oh, take me around the square. So I started doing it, and I do them in Gallatin as well as Hendersonville, which is maybe 5 miles down the street. So I stay up here in Sumner County. I don't really go into Nashville because Nashville is like New York City nowadays. But yeah, I do up here in Sumner County away from the city.
Well, wait a minute. But you said 25 books since 2018. If I do that math, that's like 6 years. I'm not even good at the maths. We all know that. So it's like 6 years. And that's a lot of stuff to do in 6 years.
Well, if I back up, I made some apps back in like 2015, 2016. To give you the backstory, my wife and I went to Savannah, Georgia, maybe 2012, 2013. And I didn't really want to go. She took me kicking and screaming. And while we're down there, we took some ghost tours. I'm sure you guys have done a ghost tour. We had a blast. I thought it was awesome. Fell in love with the history and the hauntings, how it correlated. Well, the following year, maybe 9 months later, she and I went back and we took another ghost tour, paid like $40 for this high-end ghost tour. We went to like maybe four or five places. It's really a ripoff. So my wife, she's aggravated. She said, you know, someone should make an app for $2. There's all the haunted places in it. So I started thinking about it, and she kept prodding me. So I bought me a Mac and taught myself how to code, and I made these apps that had haunted places, like made one for Savannah, made one for Nashville, New Orleans, Louisville, Boston, Salem, all these big cities. And so I kind of had all these notes and this template. And it sounds like I've done a lot of books in a short amount of time, and I guess I have. But, you know, I'm like last night I was up till 10:30 working on something that'll come out next year. Just no days off. And I kind of had all these notes from years earlier and just applied that to the books and really dug in and went to the archives and read all the newspapers, met with historians, and really fleshed out the stuff that was in the apps.
That's the key. It's really when you get into that deep dives on it that you start discovering pieces of the stories you didn't even expect, you know, and that's always fun. So
yeah, I always tell people, like, I have no life. My wife hates me, you know, but it's fun. It's just, it's my life.
Well, this is her fault based on the story you told me. So yes, be careful what you wish for. So doing all this stuff, what about, you know, when we talked, I'm sure we could ask you a million haunting stories, but you were actually joining us at Scarefest to do a panel on grave robbing.
Yes, ma'am.
So where did you go down that rabbit hole?
Oh, man. I did some books about the Midwest a couple years ago, and there's grave robbing everywhere. It happened, like you said, in Chattanooga. There's a big market there because there's a couple of medical colleges. But when I got to the Midwest, I discovered there was this industry in the 1800s where you had all these colleges, like in Cincinnati. I think they were 3 to 9 medical schools, depending on what year it was. And during that time, they only got a few bodies from the county each month. So if you died in a jail or a hospital, no one claimed your body in 3 days, the medical colleges would claim your body and they would divide them up for their students to dissect. But it's supply and demand. You have the demand, you don't have the supply. You have hundreds of kids in each college and you're getting maybe 1, 2, 3 bodies a month for each college. So these colleges, if they don't get people cadavers for their students, you know, they're going to have to close down. So they hire folks to raid the graveyards. It's nuts. And this stuff was going on back in like the 1700s. Up in New York City, they were rioting. I think it was the early 1800s. It's called the Resurrection Riots, where this kid went to a medical college, or he was looking in the window. It happened to be a medical college. And this doctor picked up this limp hand and waved it. And goes, "Hey, hi from your mom." And it's just kind of, his mother's already dead, so he really took it personal. And he went and told his dad, and his dad got some of his buddies, and they spread the word, and they just descended upon this medical college, had this big riot. It was just nuts. They had one in St. Louis that they ransacked this college when they found this little boy's playing baseball or whatever sport it was with his buddies, and they knocked the ball over the fence. He hopped the fence and found this pit of just bones. And so he told his buddies. His buddies told the parents that came and found all these bones. And they were trying to figure out, you know, what's this from? It's another riot. So yeah, this stuff's been going on for years, and the stories are so over the top because you got to think back in like 1870 or whenever it was. You can make $20 a week working the docks as a common laborer, right?
Right.
Well, you can make $40 in one night by stealing one cadaver. And that's roughly $1,300 in our money today. So the shenanigans are through the roof. Like, I've got stories, I think they're in Chicago, where this one guy robbed a morgue and got like half a dozen bodies in one night. I mean, that set him for a couple months.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the shenanigans are off the charts because the money is so good. And the stories I've uncovered over the years are just, they're unbelievable. They're better than a ghost story.
That's part of it. And I always love when people see those graves that have the cages on them. Yeah. And all that. And people are like, "Oh, that's because they were afraid of vampires coming or zombies coming up." And go, "No, that was to prevent grave robbing."
When I did my Knoxville book, I found this article where this guy had placed explosives in his brother's grave because he was worried because they had like a bunch of grave robbings around the same time as his brother died. And he put a bomb in the casket. So it's like people were very determined back then to keep the ghouls and grave robbers out of their friends and family's coffins.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense because especially if you have a belief system where, you know, if you mess with the dead body, you've ruined their afterlife. I mean, that's kind of a horrible situation. Also, they didn't do quite the entombment that they require now in most places. I mean, you know, now don't they have to put them in cement, put the coffin in cement, and put the cement in the ground for the most part?
Depends on the place.
Every state or county has different requirements. Yeah. But I mean, you're right. Back then, they typically supplied like a little cedar coffin or like the potter's fields where they buried the paupers and poor people. They just threw them in the grave and threw some dirt on them. So, and usually it was the paupers' graves, the potter's fields that got raided first because no one was really watching those. Like if you were a very affluent person, like there's a story in Nashville where this very wealthy family had a loved one passed away. They hired some grave robbers, some detectives and just family members to go sit in the graveyard. And sure enough, later that night, some guys hopped the fence with shovels and an oil lamp, bang, shot him dead. You know, it's...
Wow. That's a new job we should take on, Mark, is we will just sit and make sure you can't rob graves. I like that job.
That's sitting up with the dead. That's where we get the term graveyard shift.
Once I guess it was like the early 20th century, mid 20th century, they started figuring out people want to donate their bodies to science, and it pretty much eradicated grave robbing. It just almost just cut it off altogether because if people were willingly giving their bodies for medical research, there's no need to go raid the graveyards.
No reason to pay for those and all that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it also was some of the fallout from like H.H. Holmes and some of the other cases and all that in the early 1900s
each place was kind of slow. Like when they tried to rob Abraham Lincoln's grave in Illinois, that set off a firestorm where all these lawmakers are trying to, because it used to be like it wasn't even a misdemeanor in some states or some counties, but as like, you know, a prominent person's loved one was stolen, or like the Lincoln case, or even Andrew Jackson in Tennessee, the legislature got together. It's okay. We need, instead of a slap on the wrist or $100 fine, now it's 10 years. And that was also a pretty big deterrent as well.
Yeah.
Cause like, I think it was Cincinnati, it was Ohio. There's a guy named Ernest Doakey, and he got popped, and there was no law in the books for stealing a body. So they got him for stealing a rosewood coffin, which is worth, I think, like $14, which would have been like 80 or 100, whatever it is in our money now. I don't know if the calculator says, but
oh, see, you're having a time like me with the math. Yeah. I appreciate that.
But his attorney went and talked to the cabinet maker, because back then the cabinet makers were the undertakers. They built the cabinets, they built the coffins, and they determined that the coffin he stole was actually just a cedar coffin. It wasn't rosewood. So it wasn't worth but like a few dollars. So he got off because the DA trumped up the charge on him. It's just the shenanigans. It's just wild, the stuff they did, and they got away back then.
Oh, that was the movie we talked about, was the I Sell the Dead, which is one, if you're into grave robbing stories, that's a fantasy one. But Ron Perlman and a bunch of great actors in that. Definitely check it out sometime. So,
okay.
Now, you're also in, like us, you're into the weird stuff. I mean, ghosts are good, but we like the crazy, right? The things that don't make sense.
Yeah, anything that makes for a good story, I'm all about it.
That's, you're right up our alley here. So let's dive in. What's one of your faves?
Oh, man. You talking about like cryptids or like galvanism?
However you want to take this.
Galvanism.
Okay.
But start with, what is galvanism?
Okay. Right. So back in 1815, Mary Shelley, she published Frankenstein. It was the first science fiction novel in the world. And so as the years go on, all these doctors and crackpot scientists, they start reading this book thinking, oh, I can do that. I can rob a body. So galvanism, it's like the process of using a galvanized body to put current through a cadaver. And really all it is like what happened was they would take people who were hanged or executed, and they would they usually buy their body for silver. They give them silver while they're still alive. And once they had the hanging take place, once the sheriff said they were dead, the doctor or scientist would take the body and take it back to his office to try to revive it. And like in some places, it was a big thing. It's like, you know, what if they do revive him? You know, the Senate said he had to be hanged by the neck. Well, he was hanged by the neck, but they brought him back. So it's just, as some of the stuff was going on, it really played out in the press. Hey, what do we do if they bring him back? But anyway, what happens was they brought him back to their office. They'd apply the wires to their temple and to their spine. And what happened was electricity shot through your body. It would make your muscles twitch and spasm. Like people would sit up off the table, their eyes would open, their mouth would move, their arms would raise up, their fists would clench. It gave the appearance of being alive. Like I've got stories in South Nashville, Franklin, Tennessee, Knoxville, St. Louis, Chicago. I mean, it was a thing. And like these reporters see this stuff and it's just, oh my God, he's alive. But once the current died, because the batteries back then didn't last maybe 30 seconds, they fall back. And like, okay, they're dead again. But there was my favorite one is in South Nashville. There was a medical college called Lindsley Hall. Today it's a government building. It's part of the Ben West complex. It's still there. Well, this guy named Knox Martin, he was hired as a laborer to work on this guy's farm. There's a disagreement over the payment and how long he was going to work for him. So it's even weird, even make the story even crazier. The woman he lived with was like a witch from Jamaica. That's what he called her. She's like a voodoo priestess. She kept telling him, this guy's going to kill you if you don't kill him. So he's already mad at him. So he took her advice and went and beat him and his wife half to death. To death. So he's found guilty of murder. There's a doctor who gives him some silver. They take possession of his body. And as soon as he's pronounced dead, they take his body back to a cabin behind the gallows. And as this is going on, this cabin's an old cabin. Everybody there, because back then, the execution was like the fair. Thousands and thousands of people would go to witness executions. People made a lot of money by selling food and refreshments at executions. It's nuts. So after he was hanged and pronounced dead, the doctor cut him down, took him back to this shed back there behind the gallows. So everybody's just packing up against this old shed, looking in through the wood, tearing wood off the shed, looking through the windows, climbing on the roof, pulling off the roof tiles, and watching them try to rob his body. And they see him shoot off the table, they see him move around, and then he falls back. Well, the doctors, once he goes limp again, they put him in their wagon and take him to Lindsley Hall, the medical college. So there's like a fervor in Nashville. Oh my gosh, they've revived this body. So they go back to Lindsley Hall and they're silent. They don't really say what happens. And I think the reason is like one of the doctors wanted to write a pamphlet about what had happened. And he wanted to publish it and make some money, but they're tight-lipped on everything. Well, a few days later, the Tennessean is the big newspaper in Nashville. The editor for the Tennessean gets a letter from a guy, I think, in Lafayette, which is south of Nashville, saying, hey, I met a guy. He told me his name is Knox Martin. He's a tall African-American gentleman. And he's walking to Alabama. That's where he's from. And so he publishes that in the Tennessean. A couple of days later, someone in Montgomery sends another letter. Hey, Knox Martin is here. He's walking to his mother's house. Huh. Even stranger, a few days after that, someone sends a prominent businessman's in Nashville a tintype picture of Knox Martin and a piece of rope they were claiming it was used to hang him. Wow. So it's like, I'm 99% sure this guy didn't live. But like, what? Nashville's going nuts thinking, what is going on? Did this guy really survive? Did they really revive him at the college? Is he walking home to see his mother? What's going on? So yeah, the trail goes cold after that. But for a week or two, Nashville was buzzing about this guy they brought back to life.
We were working on the Harris murders in Asheville for a project that we're working on. And, the murder spree that happened, and then he got gunned down, but then they brought the body back to town. But was it him? Because it was so destroyed, they couldn't prove it was him. They're like, oh, no, it was 100% him. We got him. And, then there's stories. Oh, well, he's over here. He's in this town. And it's like, no, that was him.
I have a story similar to that. It's actually in my New York book that just came out a couple of days ago.
Hey, there we go. Plug time.
So you've heard of Samuel Colt, right? The guy who pretty much modernized the revolver. He was industrialist, famous, one of the wealthiest men in the world at the time. Well, as Samuel Colt's at his peak, or right there about to peak, his brother John, who was older than him, he wrote textbooks and sold them. He was nowhere near as successful as Samuel. He kind of wrote his brother's coattails. Well, as Samuel's taken off, there's a guy who John had, he hired him to print the books to sell to the colleges. There's some kind of disagreement. And the guy came to his office and they started fighting. And the guy started choking John Colt. Well, John reaches down on his desk and gets a hatchet and starts just bludgeoning the guy over his head. And the guy falls back dead. And John's like, oh my, what did I do? So he hires a delivery man, or expressman is what they were called back then, take the body. And he had traveled to New Orleans. So he was very familiar with New Orleans. So he addressed the shipping label to a place on Royale Street that was abandoned. So he thought he was going to ship this container by sea down to New Orleans and just get rid of the evidence. Well, there's a bad storm and the ship couldn't take off. So all the crew's walking by like, oh, it smells awful. Oh, what's that smell? Well, somebody opens it up and they found the decomposing body of the guy. His name was Samuel Adams, not the Boston guy, the Patriot guy, that was his name. Yeah. So the sheriff comes, deputies come, they figure out, hey, there's a nosy neighbor that was like paying attention to John and kind of watching him because he kept hearing noises in his office that day they were fighting. So he tells the sheriff what he heard. So they arrest John. He's charged with murder. His attorney thought it was a slam dunk case of self-defense. Well, no, the jury, they found him guilty. He was going to hang. So as this is going on, Samuel's plotting and scheming behind the scenes. You know, he's one of the wealthiest men in the world. So a few days before the execution, he slips a burlap sack in. He's taking John some clothes. You know, he wants him to have a nice suit to be hanged in. Well, inside that bag is a dress. So he shaves John's beard in his cell. He puts on a dress. They try to sneak out. And they almost make it, but they got caught. I think the old man, the keeper of the jail, found him. They had to go back. But the day of John's execution, he got married to his lady he was living with. And shortly after they got married, he went back to his cell. Well, there's a fire in the prison. You know, what are the odds?
Oh, wow.
So wow. Everybody's scrambling to put the fire out. It's, you know, some inmates kind of slip out. Well, they go back to John's cell. John Colt has killed himself. His face is covered in blood all over his body. So John Colt has committed suicide right before they can hang him. Well, a couple years later, a reporter goes to San Francisco for the gold rush. And he sees John Colt and some of his friends there in San Francisco trying to get gold.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you Google this, you'll go in this rabbit hole. But the lady that John Colt married before his execution was a girl that Samuel Colt got knocked up in Scotland. Samuel wanted John to marry her so that the child would have the Colt name so he could provide for it. Because if it's, you know, without the Colt name, it's just another bastard in New York City.
Yeah.
But with the Colt name, Samuel can take care of it, John's here or not. So it's, some say Samuel Colt really did commit suicide, but with all the stuff Samuel's doing behind the scenes, it wouldn't surprise me at all if he arranged for another body to be shanked and put in his cell. And he could have paid off a coroner or official, whoever, you know, okay, yeah, he's dead, throw him in a box, it's over. So yeah. It's just nuts, the stuff that went on. Like you said, you know, is it him, is it not? That just reminded me of the John Colt story.
We've done so much digging on these things, and it's fun when you start really getting into the nitty-gritty on these things and you start finding, okay, wait a minute, there's a bunny trail here that somebody needs to follow, although it was 1800s. And so, of course, yellow journalism on top of it makes it tough to really dig in. But yeah, who knows? Who knows?
But I mean, if you think about it back then, you know, we're so used to forensics. Like, it's interesting when you think that, like, O.J. Simpson was one of the first trials that tried to introduce DNA. That did not go well. I'm not even going to go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, that was one of the first trials. They brought up DNA, right? Mm-hmm. That wasn't so long ago.
Yeah.
And so you think back to what forensics, even fingerprints, like all sorts of stuff, and you start putting sort of timelines on it and being able to tell whose blood is who and do a DNA test. Because, like, to your point on some of this, you destroy the face of somebody, you know what I mean? Like, how do you know it's that person for real, Z? Unless they have, like, a distinguishing mark somewhere on their body. But tattoos were not as prevalent as they are now. There weren't, like, necessarily ways to do it. So it's so easy to think that somebody with that much money went, okay, I'm going to try to sneak out. And if I can't sneak out, this is plan B. Go light the prison on fire, right?
Yeah.
Because again, there weren't fire trucks, there weren't fire hydrants putting out a fire.
That was the brigade from the creek or the folks' water source.
Right.
Exactly. It was a whole ridiculous thing to do that. So it's so interesting to me when you think about it and you go, there weren't necessarily photographs the same way. I mean, people did photographs, but you had to sit still for however long, right, for the camera.
And you couldn't smile because the teeth would, like, glare and cause the photo to be useless.
Smiling and photos didn't happen until, what, the 1960s, I think, or 40s or 50s is when people finally started smiling. So,
you know, the rabbit hole I can go down is spirit photography. You ever guys hear about that?
Oh, man, yeah, that's all kinds of fun.
What is spirit photography?
It's actually in the New York book, too, another shameless plug.
I love it.
But I have other books that talks about it, but just I thought about that because you guys said photography. Yep. There was a guy in New York City, Mumford, I believe was his name.
Yep.
He moved to town. He had done it in Boston. And what he did was he was doing, because back then there's a lot of, you had to be a scientist to take a picture. You had to, like, have the glass, you had to dip it in some chemicals. You had to put it in there. You had to lift the cloth, let the light expose the glass. You had to take it off and put it somewhere dark for a while. They exposed it to more chemicals. Process for making a picture was, it took almost an hour or two to do it. Well, there's a guy in Boston who was doing this, and somehow he was making other people show up in his pictures. And he was telling people, oh, that's your cousin Johnny. That's your sister. And he was doing this in Boston, and he made a fortune, but somehow someone found out he'd done something nefarious, and he moved to New York City. Well, New York City is a bigger city, more people, and he just made a killing. Yeah, he got brought into court. They found him all guilty. But because it couldn't prove he actually did what he's accused of, he got off. He kind of went away, but he stopped doing the spirit photography. But yeah, they couldn't find him guilty because they couldn't figure out how he did it. But he was doing something.
They didn't know double exposure and things like that yet, which is what he was doing. We had that whole thing when we were talking about Ed Walters and the Gulf Breeze UFOs. That was in the 80s, and they were still, he was basically doing that same thing from the 1890s.
But during that time, though, in those people's defenses, the Civil War is still fresh. People or their loved ones went off to Tennessee or Georgia or Mississippi, wherever they went, and they just never came back. So people never had closure. So this guy can go around saying, oh, I got a picture of your cousin Johnny who went off to fight at Chickamauga. Oh, please take my picture with him. You know, he'd charge, I think, like $5 or $10, which is like a few hundred dollars in our money. So the guy made a fortune.
Yeah, this is, you know, Fox sisters and all that was going on. Victorian spiritualism was huge at this time again. Mm-hmm. So, and it come back full force. And then there was the other guy who was doing the ectoplasm photos.
Who's the guy who wrote Sherlock Holmes? He was involved in
that. Conan Doyle. Yeah, Conan Doyle was fascinated by it.
Yeah, he gave lectures in New York City. They're actually about in the book. Another shameless plug. Yeah, he was a brilliant man, but he was kind of hook, line, and sinker on the spiritualism stuff. Like, it was the Scotland fairies and the ectoplasm. Yeah, he was all about that stuff.
And Houdini was like, stop. You're falling for the wrong things. I know how to do this. I'm a magician. I can show you how to do this.
We need to take a quick moment of silence for our break.
It's on, the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. Buy two select laundry appliances and get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop all things Maytag, including the new stackable Pet Pro laundry system that removes pet hair from clothes. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Greetings, travelers. Now available on Audible and other audiobook platforms, Erie Appalachia. Join us, won't you, as we discuss creatures like the Popelik Monster, the White Fangs, the Snallygaster, the Wampus Cat, the Lizard Man of Skateboard Swamp, Bunny Man Bridge, and the Ohio Grassman. All these creatures and more await you if you dare listen to Erie Appalachia, presented by Mark Muncy, History Press, and Four Horsemen Publishing.
And we're back. Okay, good. That's
that was,
all we need.
That was so long.
It was horribly, horribly long.
Thank you. Thank you, sponsors, for playing those wonderful commercials. And hopefully you all...
life gets to hear. I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do have a question for you. So you talked about your wife getting you to go to this ghost tour. Have you been into the paranormal for a long time?
Well, I lived in a haunted house in Nashville for years.
Oh, do tell.
Well, back in 98, my great-grandfather passed away. In 05, 07, whenever it was, my great-grandmother, my family put her in a nursing home. She was pushing 100 years old, and she couldn't take care of herself. So to back up, if you're familiar with Nashville, there's a historic house in South Nashville called Traveler's Rest. It belonged to Judge John Overton. He was a Superior Court Justice. He was Andrew Jackson's best friend. He's a very affluent guy. He founded the city of Memphis with Jackson. So in the 50s, my great-grandparents bought 2 acres from the descendants and built a house there. Well, the first night, my uncle called and said, hey, can you come take care of this place? Would you move in? And I said, sure. So I moved in. The first night I'm there, a trash can in the kitchen moved 8 feet in the middle of the night. I woke up and there's a trash can in the middle of the floor and just kind of, that wasn't there last night. So I'm there a little longer. I noticed there's a light in the den. Each night I'd turn it off, wake up each morning, it'd be on. I come home from work in the afternoons and all the TVs be on. I had 3 TVs in the house and all 3 would be on. Just weird stuff. You know, I mean, I kind of figured it was something going on because I knew the land had a lot of history. Well, in the 1300s, it was the Indian village. And then the 1800s is the working plantation. So there's some history there. After a while, something happened, and I hopped over the fence and walked to the mansion. I talked to someone who worked there in the house. And they're like, oh, I can assure you there's no ghosts, and nothing happens here. No such thing as ghosts. You're wasting your time. Okay, thank you. So I go to leave, and this lady gets out of her car. She's wearing the period attire. She's a volunteer. I said, ma'am, I live right over here. Strange things are happening. You know, is this place haunted? She goes, honey, there's so many ghost stories here, but I'm not allowed to tell you. I said, okay, I get it. So weird things happen. Someone told me they saw a lady in my bedroom. The weirdest thing happened was when my grandmother passed away, my aunt and my cousin came and cleaned out the front room, which was the old living room. All her belongings were in that room. Well, my aunt and my cousin came and cleaned out the room. I was in the other part of the house. They leave on the side of the house I was on. The door closes. I hear a crash in that side of the house. So I run over there, and there is a fireplace. And there was this mirror that had been there for like 40 years. It probably weighed 30 pounds. It didn't drop and fall off the mantle. It didn't drop and roll off one side. Something threw it 8 feet down the hallway. So I called my uncle. I said, you know, I've told you some weird things happened here. This is the only thing that's kind of really alarmed me. That mirror over the fireplace, something threw it down the hallway 8 feet. And he started laughing. So that's the only thing that really unnerved me there. But yeah, I've kind of been knee-deep in this stuff for a while.
That's good.
Wow. Did your grandparents ever tell you about anything in the house, or did you just get to encounter it when you had to move in?
No, I mean, and I talked to a historian because when the Overtons were there, I was told that my property would have been like a stable. So it may have been from the Native American times. It could have been something when my grandmother got mad, they moved her stuff. I don't really know. But when I did my book on South Nashville, I found that the guy across the street from me, they were redoing their front yard and dug up a tree. And when they did, they found a skeleton with like a Civil War uniform on, and the vines were all twisted through a skeleton. So the Battle of Nashville was fought like a mile or two away. But John Bell Hood, the Confederate general, Traveler's Rest was his headquarters. So they were all around there. I don't think they really had the battle in my front yard or anything, so to speak. But there's a lot of history there from the natives, the plantation, and then the war, too. So who knows?
Well, and yeah, and these battlefields, I mean, the battlefield proper is one thing, but then the wounded and everything were everywhere. People don't realize that. So
yeah, like that guy, the soldier they found, he probably went to that tree and just laid down.
Laid down and... That was it. They probably buried him right there going, who is this guy? Who knows? Just bury him. Yeah. That was so common back then because if he wasn't an officer, it didn't matter.
Well, they had mass graves and stuff like that too.
On top of that too, yeah. Yeah.
They didn't keep track of everybody. Way too many bodies, way too few people to bury them.
Oh, yeah.
I think people don't realize. So was that your first encounter or did you have encounters when you were younger?
No. And I have a friend of mine, she calls herself an empath. She tells me she can't see a ghost. She can sense and feel them. Mm-hmm. I'm not on that wavelength. I've only seen one. I've heard doing this for so long. I've heard things and then seen weird things. Well, I've only seen one apparition and that was in Gallatin, Tennessee. There's a historic house called Rosemont and it belonged to a judge named Josephus Con Gill. He wasn't a player. He was kind of a background guy. He was buddies with Andrew Jackson, Polk, and Johnson, the three Tennessee presidents. But he had this huge mansion, and weird things happened there all the time. I went there one day to see the director, and I pulled up. I didn't see his Jeep, so I parked in the front yard, and I walked through the breezeway on the side of the house. And as I'm walking through this breezeway, I turn to my right, and I look in the reception area, and I see a man in a fedora turn to the side. I look again, and the guy's gone. So I messaged the director. I said, hey, tell me I'm crazy, but there's a guy in a fedora back there in the reception area. And he wrote back, oh, you saw Squire. Well, who's Squire? Well, Judge Guild, all of his children became judges and attorneys. So Squire, I think, was his grandson. And unlike the other guilds in the house, his wife loved to entertain at the lavish parties in the mansion. Well, Squire, he liked to go to his garage, which is now the reception area, and tinker on his car and listen to the radio. They say that's where you could find him all the time. So I'm wondering if now today that's he's there in his happy place there in the reception area.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. You saw, I always wonder with people who research or look into the paranormal, I think, you know, there's different people that I've met that can feel them, see them, hear them, you know, different things. It's just always interesting to go, you know, how did you broach the subject to even talk about ghosts, right? Because it's there. What about monsters and stuff? So you do the whole gamut. Do you do research into monsters, cryptids, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yes and no. It's just you kind of stumble across things. Like doing these books, I did a book on New Jersey, and you find these stories about these sailors and old sea captains, and they'd be out at sea, and they would see a sea serpent or a sea monster. And then like 2 weeks later, they see it again, you know, in Atlantic City or in the Long Island Sound, like you see up down the East Coast. And they just, it's like a thing. It's like the Tennessee River Monster in Chattanooga. They would see it here, they'd see it there, and there's one in New Orleans, but they saw it in Missouri and it went down the Mississippi River and went to New Orleans. Like I find all these things and it's like, it's too cool not to really do something with. So it's like, okay, I like this book here behind me, Fear and Folklore, American Monsters, just weird crypto stuff I've found that I think is neat. You know,
that's what it's all about. I mean, we love these stories. We go to all the cryptid festivals and it's amazing to us how many people have their own stories to tell. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones that their family's monster and stuff.
And I got a story in my Florida book. It's called the What's It Fish. It's what the crew named it. They were out at sea. And this guy, he was like a well-known fisherman. Like he took presidents out on the water to find, you know, big fish. Well, they're out there and they find this, they call it a sea serpent. They know what it was. So really it was like a 60 or 80 foot long whale shark. Back in 1920, 1930, you don't know what a whale shark is. You know, it's a sea monster. So the guy, he's out there for a couple of days battling it. He's out there so long, his crew, like, wants to plan a mutiny. Like, he holds them off at gunpoint from cutting the lines from the harpoons. It's like, he's going to get this fish, come hell or high water. So he finally gets the fish. He gets help from another boat. And then he takes it back to the shore, and he stuffs it and carries it around the country and makes a fortune. But I'm not sure if it's on Google, but I found this in old newspaper articles. But yeah, it's the What's It Fish. He took it. He sold it somewhere up north, and then he weaseled his way out of the deal and came back home and sold it to somebody else. And yeah, they kept talking about how bad it smelled everywhere they went.
That sounds like our hodag. The guy tried to sell to the Smithsonian, and when they really were serious, he's like, it died. We had to kill it.
No, it's so interesting. And again, you think about the fact that taxiderming fish and putting the big marlin up on your wall was not a thing back then, especially for something like a whale shark, which is huge.
Yeah, and you're trying to use plaster and all the stuff to keep it together, and it was just falling apart and smelling so bad. He made a fortune charging people a quarter or whatever he was charging to see it.
Oh, yeah, that was the secret back then, was, you know, quarter a pop. That was the Ringling.
Yep.
Yeah, Ringling and P.T. Barnum. That's how they did a sucker born every minute.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So what is a monster that surprised you when you started looking into it?
Oh, man, it's hard to say. There's something like the Jersey Devil's fun. But then again, the Jersey Devil's kind of like the Bell Witch in Tennessee. It's a story of a tale that's become a legend. You don't really know what's what.
Yep.
See, there's one called the Hendersonville Shadow in Tennessee. Back behind the Cumberland River in Sumner County, it was the old Native American land. They find arrowheads, and Native energy is darker than other spirits or whatever you want to call them. I met a guy who told me that he would see this shadow up in a tree, and he would see it running in the woods. It was almost like a monkey, but it was like a man. And it's something like a lot of folks have seen out here in Sumner County. It's the Hendersonville Shadow. I'm not sure if you can Google it. I thought was just really, really intriguing.
We were finding about the Hendersonville Devil Monkey was another term for it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then and the shadow turned out. I was like, oh, okay. So it's got a couple names here. So
okay, I heard that one.
No, I think it's always fascinating. What is the story that you started to research and then found that kind of completely fell apart?
What's the one of in New York where the guy was pranking his buddy and he put a bunch of wood and stuff out in the water? I can't remember. It was a well-known hoax, but I think it's back in New York State. It wasn't New York City, New York State. And he was putting timber and wood out there to resemble a monster, and his buddies would go nuts. It's in the book. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head. But yeah, that one was really funny to read, because the guy tried to keep it going for as long as he could.
Pranking's fun until you really scare or piss off your friends, and then they get revenge, right? Where's somewhere you want to travel to investigate things?
Well, it's funny you say that. I probably shouldn't. I guess I will. I've got a lot of notes for San Francisco. I've got sea monsters. I got grave robbing at Ghost Stories. But like, you watch the news, and San Francisco is kind of like the place not to be right now. So I'm going to hold off for a little while, and hopefully it gets better out there.
Hopefully improve soon.
Yeah.
Now, we had some recent guests that had been, you know, talking, you know, Bigfoot in Eastern Tennessee and Western North Carolina that quite a bit. So do you touch on any of that in your research? Or
yeah, and again, it's kind of like the Jersey Devil, a story of a tale has become a legend. But I did have a story in the book, and I call it the stench, because that's what the lady called it. And it was a guy who I know, who I trust, was telling me when his mother was younger, she's a teenager in Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is south of Franklin, kind of out there. I mean, it's really developed now, but years ago it was nothing. She's walking down this path one day, and Sherman saw this big, like larger than a gorilla, and started chasing her. And she said that as scared as she was, the only thing she remembered was the stench. She always called it the stench. Mm-hmm. And my buddies tell me, like, you know, my mother was a church-going, God-fearing woman. She would never make something like this up. To her dying day, she swore that the stench chased her through that path. And the only reason it stopped was when she got to her home, she was screaming for her dad. Her dad walked out to the front yard with a shotgun, and that's what scared it away. But I guess it's a ancestor or a relative of Bigfoot. I don't really know, but it's all the similarities of Bigfoot.
Well, stench gives it the skunk ape, you know, feel. Oh. So, yeah. We've had many stories about the smells. I don't know if they bathe a lot. So.
Yeah, I got tickled because she called it the stench. I'm like, that's just too cool of a name to not.
That's a great name.
Check with the stench.
I like that.
I love that name. That's a perfect name. What is your favorite story that you've looked into so far? Something that you really, really thoroughly enjoyed? Because you've got so many. So is there one that you absolutely adore?
Well, you alluded to it earlier. It's a Gray Robin story. It's called the Harrison Horror. And I'm going to be a while telling this. So Benjamin Harrison. You guys are familiar with Benjamin Harrison. He's a former Union general. After the war, his grandfather was William Henry Harrison, our 9th president. Hmm. Benjamin Harrison's a future president. So after the war, he goes back home to Indianapolis because his father, John Scott Harrison, is a congressman. And Benjamin Harrison wants to start his own legacy in Indianapolis and become his own man. You know, his grandfather's a president, the Tippecanoe War, the War Hero of War of 1812. John Scott is a congressman. Some big shadows there. So Benjamin Harrison goes to Indianapolis to start his law practice, and he does really, really well. Well, I think it was 1878, he gets a telegram. Hey, your father's passed away. I need you to come home or lay your father to rest. So he goes to North Bend, Ohio, right outside Cincinnati, and he meets his brothers and sisters, and they have a service for their father, and they lay him to rest. Mm-hmm. Well, after the service, they're walking around the graveyard, and his sister walks over to her son's grave. He was buried the week before. He died from tuberculosis, consumption. So she falls to the ground, starts screaming, just flailing, making a scene. Benjamin runs over there with his brothers and his cousins, and they look, and they see the ground's been disturbed, and one of the brothers is like, hey, you know, is there a wild boar in the area? And someone's like, no, this is as much... something's going on. It's got to be a grave robber. You know, they dig a little bit, and the coffin's disturbed. The body's missing. So Benjamin, he's a future president, right? He has to go back to Indianapolis to give a speech a few days later. The GOP, you know, he's a prominent guy. He has to be there. So he tells his younger brother, Johnny, and his cousin, George, all right, you guys go to Cincinnati. You find out where our nephew is.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, Johnny and George go, they hire a former sheriff, Chief Snellbecker, to be their liaison in town to help find out what's going on. So late that night, they get a search warrant and go to the Ohio Medical College there by the river. So they're poking around. They go to the 5th floor, and they walk over the corner of the room, and they find this shaft, and there's a rope dangling down. So the chief walks over, and he pulls on the line. Oh, it's Top Boy. Something's on the line. So he finds this wheel, and this dark form materializes. And all they have is, you know, like candles and oil lamps. There's no electricity back then. So they pull the body, pull it up out of the shaft. The chief said, Johnny, come here. Is this your nephew? So Johnny walks over with his candle, and he pulls a shawl back over the figure's face. No, it's not Augustus. It's some old man. And the chief said, well, here, take my oil lamp, and you'll make sure. So Johnny goes back and pulls the face up or the shawl up, and he just stumbles backwards. It's his dad. The grave robbers beat him in Cincinnati in 24 hours. So after that, Benjamin Harrison gets no telegram. He comes back to Cincinnati. It's scorched earth. He wants the administrator's head on a pike and their bodies fed to the fish in the Ohio River. So, but he's getting pushback from all the administrators because they can't rat out their ghouls. They got to have the cadavers. So it's kind of like they want to be nice to Benjamin because, you know, the guy they stole is a congressman and the son of a president, but they got to protect their grave robbers. So Benjamin, he's going after him tooth and nail. He's giving interviews to the local newspapers, trying to put heat on the administrators. Well, they never can catch the guy. So you know why they can't catch the guy? He's a British spy. A month before in Toledo, Ohio, there's a guy got popped in the graveyard. His name's Thomas Beach. They throw him into jail. A few days later, he goes to the jailer. Hey, I've got smallpox. You got to get me out of here. Look at all these sores on my hands. So back then, smallpox is not a death sentence for you. It's for everybody in the jail. So the jailer throws him in the pest house. Well, Thomas Beach, during the Civil War, he fought for the Union. He's from England, but he came here to fight for the Union, young man, sense of adventure. He actually fought in the Battle of Nashville. Afterwards, he goes to Illinois. He starts practicing medicine, becomes a pharmacist. He realizes, hey, there's more money in grave robbing than there is practicing medicine. So he knew by breaking his hands out that he'd get thrown in the pest house, and he escaped. So he came and stole the body. Well, while he was in the Civil War fighting for the Union, he gets embedded with some guys from Ireland. At the time, during conscription, you could pay people to take your place if you had money. So a lot of poor Irish immigrants took the money and took the place of wealthy people. So a lot of Irishmen fought for the Union. Well, Thomas became friends with guys from Ireland, and after the war, they formed this group called the Fabian Brotherhood, which is basically a terrorist organization. They started launching raids up into Canada, which is protected by the British. So as his buddies are raiding Canada, Thomas sends letters to his dad. His dad takes him to Parliament. He becomes a protected British asset. So in England, he is a hero. But in America, he's a scourge of the earth. He stole the body of the son and father of the United States president. It's nuts. Like, I'm researching this, like, weeks. it's like a roller coaster. And you think you're done, but you get done and you're back over here, and the loop way over here you got to do. It's the wildest thing I've ever found. And it's like Hollywood cannot make this stuff up, but it's just nuts.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So it's like the James Bond of grave robbing.
Yeah, you can say that. He got away with it.
That's crazy.
But they did find Augustus, their nephew. They found him in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The sheriff got a lead on a tip, and they found another body in a basement of another medical college. And he put pressure on the janitor to say, hey, you know, what's going on? He said, well, there was a man here a few days ago, and they shipped him to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he went up there the next day, and that's where they found him. So they got their dad, their nephew back, and laid him to rest. But it's wild.
Oh, man. This is the stuff that, you know, TV movies of the week should do.
Yeah, I just read a screenplay about it. And it's wild because, like, the Cincinnati Inquirer, local paper in Cincinnati, they called it the Harrison Horror. And, like, it played out over, like, a month in the newspapers. It was a huge deal. Probably sold a million papers up there. But, like, over the years, people just forgot about it. And it's just, I uncover this, and it's like, holy, I can't believe this.
We are getting near the end. Will you tell us where you're going to be next, where people can come and meet you?
Yeah, I'll be, see here. I set up at the Nashville Farmers Market most weekends. I'll be at Scarefest in Lexington. I'll be at the Gallatin Square Fest October 5th, Franklin, Tennessee Pumpkin Fest last Saturday in October. I'm somewhere. You can find me on the social media, on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram.
Wow, very, very cool. And your newest book that came out?
The one here is Ghost Stories and Graveyard Tales, New York City. I got Southern Ghost Stories, Knoxville, it dropped. Ghost Stories and Graveyard Tales, Alabama. Fear and Folklore, American Witches. And I feel like I'm forgetting one or two of them.
Well, with 25, I can understand that. Thank you, Alan, so much for being on the show with us. I really appreciate it. I learned stuff. I know our travelers have learned stuff. They've commented on it.
Thanks for having me.
That was amazing, and so much fun stories and all that. So we will put your information in the show notes, so anybody who tunes in can find it. And we will see you at Scarefest.
I'll be there. I'll find you.
Mark, you got to take us away, my friend.
All right. Well, with that, gang, thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you for those of us who joined us live on YouTube and Instagram and all the other fun places. And for those of you who didn't, keep an eye on eerietravels.com. See when our next one is. We've got more coming up soon. And for those of you listening on audio, thanks again for tuning in. And as always, thanks for sharing and letting others know about us. And we keep on doing these eerie travels for you. And again, for our guest, thank you, Alan. And go buy his books. Go take one of his tours if you're in that area near Nashville. But, you know, a little north and avoiding the crowds.
There you go.
But thanks again, Alan, for coming on. Yes, and as you're out there in the woods and you're walking late at night, or if you're walking by that graveyard and you hear some strange noises going on, just remember it's usually private property and best not to go in because you don't want to be visited by a dark spirit. It's usually the police. And we will see you on the other side.
It's on, the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. Buy two select laundry appliances and get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop all things Maytag, including the new stackable Pet Pro laundry system that removes pet hair from clothes. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.